Hello, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And thank you so much, everyone, for coming today on this beautiful day outside. Today we have a wonderful bread basket from Great Harvest Bread Company and has a lot of wonderful things in there. And I understand there aren't very many tickets that have been sold. So chances are very high. If any of you out there are good at statistics, you might want to rush to the front door. There's still a few more minutes to get a ticket. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program is being recorded for a couple of TV stations and the radio. So if you could turn off your cell phone, they'd all appreciate that. Speaking of recording, I'd like to thank Will Toyer, who's recording for KSKA. This program will be available online at alaskapublic.org early next week if you want to hear it again or send it to your friends. And thank you very much to KSKA for recording this program. It is actually not, it is too late to apply for your PFDs, but it's not too late to designate a charitable organization under Pick, Click, and Give. You can do that up through August, so if anyone is online, you can go back and consider your favorite organizations through this great program, and please consider the Alaska World Affairs Council. We have some books at the front counter. The 2012 Great Decision books by the Foreign Policy Association are out, and they have some great topics for 2012, the Middle East, cyber security, exit from Afghanistan and Iraq, and you can get your copy. We now have those available. If you're a student, if you could please stand and be recognized. Do we have any students? I know we're getting close to finals. Wonderful. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you, BP, for sponsoring our students and this great program. Speaking of students, I'd like to take a moment to mention a few items. First, I'd like to recognize Sarah Elton. She's actually out in the hallway. You might have seen her when you were coming in. She is our high school gifted intern with the Alaska World Affairs Council, and she's finishing up her semester with us, has done a lot of great works. We also have our World Quest winners from West High School who are heading off to Washington, D.C. for the national competition, which will occur this Saturday. There will be 225 students representing over 4,000 that will be competing in this competition to be the winner of the World Quest competition. And the World Quest is a competition for students where they are tested on geography, foreign affairs, current events, and West High has been studying very hard, and we wish them all the best. We also have some other Alaskans who are winning some National World Affairs Council competition. In addition to our World Quest winners, there were Alaskans who participated in two additional competitions. The first was for teachers to join educators from the Houston World Affairs Council to visit Saudi Arabia this past March. And Jim Cunningham from Family Partnership was one of five chosen through the whole U.S., 94 councils, to go to Saudi Arabia. And we're hoping to bring in to one of our programs next month a gentleman named Dylan Hardenberger. He's from South High School, and he won one of five spots to visit Azerbaijan this summer for an all-expense tour to learn about the region. And we are very proud of our Alaskans who are winning these national competitions. So if I could have the breadbasket ticket before I introduce the head table, we'll see who's the lucky winner today. It's coming. And Lou, if I could ask you to pick the lucky winner for today's bread basket. Super. Hope your ticket is blue. And the winning number is 584258. If you are 584258, yes. Congratulations. Super. Now I'd like to get on and introduce our head table. To my far left is Mr. Garrett Wong, the chairman of our board, who makes my job a pleasure every day. So glad to have him. And to his right, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Joe Beadle, president and CEO of Northrim Bank, the proud sponsor of this series, Joe Beadle.
Well, Well, thank you, Lisa, Garrett, members of the board of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It is Northrend Bank's privilege and honor to partner with the Alaska World Affairs Council to bring, you know, speakers of national and international knowledge on applied economics, and especially dealing with oil and gas. I'm wearing my pin today that says, you know, we're looking for 1 million barrels a day through the Alaska pipeline, and part of this presentation is all about how Alaska can remain competitive. And we appreciate the partnership. The sixth series started in November and will end in May. And Lou is our fifth of a series of six speakers. There's another way that you can partner. This is a member organization, and by being a member of Alaska World Affairs Council, you can support causes like this and to learn about things beyond our insular or our parochial type interests. What's going on in the world does affect us. And so it is my honor today to introduce our speaker, and I'll make a couple of comments about him. He is Lou Pularisi. And Lucien Pularisi has been president of Energy Policy Research Foundation. Formerly, it was known as the Petroleum Industry Research Foundation. He's been a member of the board and president prior to even 2007, and he managed the transfer of the office from New York to Washington, D.C. for the concept of helping policymakers. He previously served on the board of trustees of the same foundation before taking over the presidency. Since leaving government in 1998, he's been associated with this organization. Mr. Pularisi worked as a consultant on a wide range of domestic and international petroleum issues. Mr. Pularisi has served in a wide range of government posts, and including the National Security Council. When you think about energy, energy is a part of our national security, and hopefully he'll make some comments. And that was at the White House. He worked for the Department of State, the Department of Energy and Interior, came to Alaska in some of those capacities early in the pipeline days, actually made the road trip all the way up to Prudhoe Bay, blew out all kinds of tires, has stories to tell. And he's worked for the EPA as well, so he knows this industry and knows all the government affairs associated with it. He's written various articles on energy issues published in the Oil and Gas Journal and other journals on Russian petroleum, also energy security and energy policy. Mark Langland, chairman and co-founder of Northrend Bank, here today with us, had the pleasure of breaking bread with Lou last night. And I'll tell you, what you might learn today is the paradigm shift, the mega trend that is occurring just at rapid pace. And I don't want to ruin the presentation, but we cannot be insular. What happens in the rest of the United States and the world does affect us. And frankly, we're going to have our challenges, and we're going to have to work for opportunities. So please join me in welcoming Lou to speak on the coming renaissance in North American oil and gas. North America may or may not include Alaska in this case. Please join me in welcoming Lou.
So first, I would like to thank Northrend Bank and the Alaska World Affairs Council, Lisa, for, is that okay? I'd like to thank Northrend Bank and the Alaska World Affairs Council. I always enjoy coming to Alaska. People are so nice, and I always learn a lot when I come up here. You know, one of the things I thought I'd like to do is sort of give you a perspective on what's happening in the oil and gas sector on the outside. And what's happening is happening so quickly now, it's really hard to get your head around it. And I have a lot of material here. I promise not to. It's generally for a more petro nerd audience. We're not going to do that. We're going to keep it very straightforward, and so everyone can access it. But you can visit our website if you want to dig into some of this stuff in more detail. So let's just get started with the first slide. And that's my job, okay. Okay, this here, as you can see, if you look on the far, I don't think I can use my pointer on this one, but if you look to the far right, We serve on the National Petroleum Council. These are the results of a study done by the National Petroleum Council. And does everybody know what the NPC does? It's a group of private, both industry and outside experts, whose only job is to advise the Secretary of Energy. Goes back to the Truman administration. And the NPC did, in response to a request from Secretary Chu, did a major assessment, both upstream and downstream. We actually sit on the downstream committee, but this is from the upstream committee, and said, you know, what could the United States, including Alaska, what could North America produce if we had continued improvement in technology, good access to federal lands, and, you know, continued a responsible regulatory regime. And what the NPC concluded was, and when this came out last November, it was quite controversial. The NPC concluded that North America could produce 10 to 12 million barrels a day of more production by 2035 than what we're producing now. By the way, this might be an underestimate. At the time, I think the NPC was widely criticized. There was a lot of people said, well, it's kind of a ludicrous idea that North America produce all this oil and gas. But I'm going to show you some things here which suggest that the NPC, if anything, was somewhat modest. And if you look at the table carefully, you can see at least 5 million barrels a day is what we call tight oil. I won't get into a big discussion about the geology and stuff. Let's call that unconventional or tight oil. This shows you the distribution of what we call unconventional reserves or shale oil. By the way, the interesting thing about shale oil is that it's from something we call source rock. And we've known about source rock forever. And source rock, everywhere there's existing oil production, there's source rock. And source rock is not producing from these fields. You know, traditionally you would drill a vertical well and you might get 800, 900, 1,000 feet of pay. In these shale discoveries, these shale, you get like 100 feet of pay. So what happened is people learned to do it horizontally. And the marriage of art and science, you know, GPS, modern computers, specialty steel, has allowed us to drill horizontally. And the horizontal drilling, as I say, is a marriage of art and science. And everywhere there's oil production in the world, there's source rock. And in the U.S., there's a lot of source rock. Now, one of the interesting things about Washington, I've spent my career in Washington, is that you find yourself I've testified before Congress many times. I remember in 2008 testifying before the Natural Resources Committee. And at that time, I was sitting on the dais with USGS and the Energy Information Agency. And both of those agencies testified, you know, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't matter how much land we lease, it doesn't matter how actively we pursue new reserves of natural gas, we are going to need to import large and substantial supplies of natural gas into the United States. And this is a very common, if you've testified in front of Congress, they run these very simple geologic models, or EIA runs their model, and they just have a certain, you know, probability distribution, and none of the models actually can get their hands around a technological breakthrough, which is what happened here. Now, what's interesting about this, you see the blue line? As late as 2008, that is what the United States government officially said the U.S. would have to import in natural gas. And if you see the red line, that's actually what we're importing. And the data there, I think we show prices at 250 to 280. I think all you know, natural gas prices in the U.S. are even lower than that now. Here's another interesting fact. The United States companies installed $30 billion of LNG receiving facilities, which today are operating at 8% capacity. That is a big capital hit. And what I say also is there's a difference between that and Solyndra, of course. In the case of Solyndra, the taxpayers have to pay, and in the case of the underutilized capital for the LNG facilities, the stockholders have to pay. So keep that in mind. Now, this surge in natural gas production in the U.S. is going to result in enormous opportunity for the downstream processing, value-added processing in the United States. And, you know, I don't know if you know about the old joke about the refining industry in the U.S., you know, the golden age of refining, you know, was great, but it only lasted 2 weeks. I mean, refining is a very tough business in the United States. It's a very low-margin business. Natural gas, you know, gas processing has been a very tough business. But that is changing now. Now, this shows you, this is our forecast of ethane and natural gas liquid production just to 2017, a very short period of time. We are going to take all of that ethane. We're going to use it into producing petrochemical products. And the U.S. right now is going to become very competitive with the Middle East. Now, this shows you that where the U.S. sits competitively in 2010. You can see the data there. It's very interesting. We were slightly more expensive than the Middle East. Today, we have the lowest cost of feedstock in the world. The United States is the most competitive country for value-added processing in the petrochemical business. Shell is now thinking of producing, building a very large ethylene cracker in the states of Pennsylvania. West Virginia and Ohio are fighting for that project. That's a big turnaround. Now this shows you how the ratio, you know, the ratio between gas and oil is very important in a lot of different fields. And you can see that when this ratio, when the value of gas versus the value of oil opens up a great deal, thermoplastic exports, those little plastic pellets, you know, they use to make everything from, all the ethylene, the propylene, and you can see what happens here from these charts. As that ratio moved up, we're already expanding production from existing facilities. The other interesting thing is the U.S. is going to win what we call the Battle of the Atlantic Basin. And what is the Battle of the Atlantic Basin? Right now, in 2011, the United States exported more petroleum products than it imported. We exported about 3 million barrels a day, mostly diesel, gasoline, some petroleum, coke, asphalt, but we imported about 2. So we're a net exporter of refined petroleum products. We're still a net importer of petroleum. We import, if you take Canada and the U.S. as a single entity, net imports of petroleum into the U.S. is actually around only 5.5 million barrels a day. But low-cost refinery fuel, access to, you know, continued well-priced feedstock is going to place the Gulf Coast refiners in an enormous position as major export platforms. Now, there's a lot of policy issues associated with that, a lot of permitting and stuff. We can talk about that later if you like. Another issue is we don't know a lot about what's happening in these shale fields. A big issue that's come up is, well, you know, we're cutting the decline rates. You know, because it's sort of a manufacturing process. You have to go back and keep fracking them and everything. So the oldest field we know is in Montana. And the North Dakota Pipeline Authority has begun to do a study of it. And this is, and even this is not that old data. This is about 20 years old data. But what we do know from this is, in these new shale fields out there, the oil production declines, but the gas production does not. We're not prepared to say you can migrate this concept to other areas. But two reasons U.S. natural gas production is holding up, even with these low oil prices, even with these low gas prices, is we're getting a lot of associated gas, and a lot of the shale fields, for example, in North Dakota, are very wet. The dry gas may only be worth $2. But the condensates, the natural gas liquids, the wet part of the gas has real value. And that's keeping that production up higher than it would be if it were just dry gas. Now, I don't know if you remember, in the old days, they used to have these big lease sales down in Louisiana. And I would go down there. I was in the Interior Department at the time. And they'd open the bid. People would applaud. You know, Exxon paid $320 million for a dry hole in the Aston Anticline or something like that. But the interesting thing is, at the end of the meeting, you would leave. There's always some guy handing out a bumper sticker. And I remember the bumper sticker I used to get said, "Drive 90, freeze a Yankee." You know, I always thought that's sort of interesting, you know. And it kind of reflected the kind of cultural war in the U.S. between these producers in the Gulf, who produced and refined and processed all this petroleum, and their view of the people in the Northeast and the West who wanted to stop them from doing it. They didn't really understand it, you know, because they thought they were producing it for the whole country. And if you look at this chart, the culture of oil and gas production is changing in the United States. It's migrating out of the Gulf into Pennsylvania, into North Dakota, into Ohio. And here's a really interesting nugget on natural gas production. Natural gas production in the U.S., shale gas, happened very quickly. Gets started in Texas, you know, the application of the Mitchell technology and everything, moves to Oklahoma, West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and then an application in North Dakota for oil fields, right? What do you think all those states have in common besides interesting geology? They have no federal land. Even North Dakota only has 1.5% federal land. And what that meant was, it was all leased. Oh, it wasn't leased to the oil companies, it was at least to private individuals. But a landman could come tomorrow and you could make a deal the next day. You cannot do that on federal land. So the technology migrated and the idea moved very quickly. It's all on private land. This shows you what's happening to the rig count and the permits. As you can see, big cluster, the blue is oil, the red is gas, and we have a big cluster of production up in North Dakota. Now, what I thought I'd do is give you a little peek at what's happening to the pace of the technology. I think that's a real key thing to understand. People always like to fight about how big the reserves are, but this is unimportant. Source rock's everywhere. It's a manufacturing process. By the way, nobody drills a dry hole anymore. Nobody drills a dry hole in shale. They know exactly, it's a manufacturing process. They know where the source rock is. They know how to get it. They don't drill a dry hole. This shows you some data from a company called Brigham. Brigham was bought by Statoil. I think the deal closed last January. But the important thing of this slide is to look at the, if you look at the green, and you can see that when they did a single frack, that is like one pipe to holes, pressurized water, and compare that to how the technology progressed over a period of just two, maybe 3 years, where they began to do multiple fracks, more pipes, the technology got better, and you can see that the finding cost dropped dramatically, the estimated ultimate recovery went up, the decline rates flattened out, and so the technology is moving very fast. Let's take a look at, this is North Dakota and Montana. Just the movement, and I want you, if you look at these dates here, you can look here from, say, 2009, 2010, you have a massive increase in production in a very short period of time. 100,000 barrels a day to over 350,000. This is happening all through the major shale plays in the U.S. This is the Williston Basin. Okay. You can see in the Williston Basin up over 550,000. Actually, it's wrong. We can't even keep up. It's 625,000 barrels today in North Dakota. It's moving at a very rapid pace. And that's why I always tell them, if you're using official government data, you're wrong. It's not EIA's fault. They just can't keep up. It's not their fault. They can't collect it, process it, and publish it fast enough. This is the trend. You know, there's been about 5.5 million holes drilled in the world. 4.5 million been drilled in North Dakota, and 4.5 million been drilled in North America, and almost all of those have only been drilled in two basins, the San Joaquin and the Permian. And this is from a little snapshot of a small area in the Permian called the Trend Area, where they're actually drilling vertically and horizontally, companies like Pioneer. And you can see here, you're getting very rapid run-up in production, 100, 150,000 barrels a day, in periods less than a year. I'm going to show you something else. This is Eagle Ford. This is one of the most remarkable plays. It's in southwest Texas. And you can see here, in a period of a year, we get massive increase in production, several 100,000 barrels a day. Now, this shows you a window, something popular with geologists, you know. And the only thing I want you to take away from this chart, although, you know, these shale plays tend to be dry gas, wet gas, crude oil, and a lot of them are very, you know, they're very wet gas fields. They have a lot of NGLs. We're going to have a lot of NGLs in the U.S. You see the border with Mexico there? Well, the geology doesn't stop there. It keeps going. The Mexicans will probably figure that out at some point. I'm not sure when, but so what does this say? You know, what are we thinking? In the four plays we are looking at, just the four plays we've looked at. We've got a young gal. She came from a drilling family, used to paint pump jacks as when she was 13 years old, and she's a graduate of LSE. We send her to the field for 10 days every month. She stays in the man camps. They trust her. And so just working this up from, you know, the drilling permits to the well completions, by the middle of 2017, on the plays we've looked at, the U.S. will lower 48. It's going to increase production by 2 million barrels a day. By the end of 2013, no more light sweet crude will be imported into the Gulf of Mexico. We're actually going to have an imbalance between light sweet and heavy crude. We're going to have to change the way we process things. By the way, if you look what's happening with the Canadian oil sands, and if we can sort of sort out our infrastructure issues for moving crude, we think it's quite reasonable to expect North America to increase oil production by 500,000 barrels a day, year in, year out. I want to talk a little bit about Keystone. And I don't want to, okay, I'm doing pretty good. You know, how it's very interesting how Washington works. When someone came to me, one of the staff came to me and said, let's write something on Keystone. You know, let's do some research on it. It should be pretty interesting. And I said, does everyone know what the Keystone Pipeline is? This is a pipeline to bring oil sands from the great Albertan oil fields all the way down to the deep Gulf where the big, massive coking complex refineries are. They're very well matched. It also would provide some extra capacity to bring production from the northern tier, and I'll show you some slides and stuff on that. But what's interesting about this, when Ben came to me and said, let's write something on it, we'll work on it. I said, well, this is a no-brainer. Why do we want to write about this? It's not even hard. I mean, nobody's going to take 10 minutes to decide this. They're going to go forward with it. It doesn't, you know, it just makes so much sense. We have never turned down a cross-border pipeline from Canada. And so we began to work on it. And we're not a very large organization. We're a small organization. And then we realized we were the only group in town that actually even published anything on this. Everybody else is working on climate or, you know, environmental stuff or every other kinds of idea. And so Resources for the Future, which I don't know if you know, it's a really eminent organization. It's been around a long time. They did this assessment. And the assessment essentially says, from a national perspective, whether the pipeline is approved or not is not really important. I think the thinking here was, well, if they don't sell it to us, they'll sell it to somebody else. But they missed two important things. One, Keystone was going to help domestic production. Because remember, we used to produce all this oil in the Gulf, process it, and move it up. Now we're producing it up in the northern tier with a surge in Canadian production, and we need to bring it down. So it's not irrelevant. We need that infrastructure. That infrastructure has value. And so we went and looked at it. We said, no, they're wrong. We get real value for improving the transportation infrastructure for crude oil, and we get real value for matching the Canadian crude oil, the dilbit, or the to the great refineries in the Gulf Coast. This shows you the distribution of crude oil pipelines in the U.S. The only reason I'm showing this to you is that it's not a new thing to build a pipeline in the U.S. We do it all the time. They're very safe. And this will give you a little sense of what's going on now. This is really interesting. I actually believe that if the president could take this one back, he would. I don't think they understood what they were doing when they pushed off the Keystone Pipeline. And frankly, he's not really constrained by anything at all. That's all. I used to work in the NSC. It's a one-page memo. He could have approved the pipeline and said, well, the Nebraskans haven't worked it out yet. When they do, they've got it. It was very easy, and I think this is the real dilemma with the administration now. Do they want to embrace this North American renaissance? Or do they just want to sort of see if they can get by? Because this North American renaissance poses a real dilemma. We had a view of the world that oil was going to be short and expensive. It now appears to be that it will neither be expensive nor short. And that means if you're going to wrench the whole economy to solar, wind, electric cars, the cost of doing that has gone way up. And so we have a real sort of challenge in front of us. Because if we embrace this North American renaissance, we're going to get enormous economic value out of value-added processing, out of new jobs, out of economic growth. But if we try to produce a lot of things whose value in the marketplace is substantially below their cost of production, we're going to have real problems. Now, if anyone is unaware of this, the middle of the United States today, if you look at these charts and you see the green and the blue refer to either Canadian or U.S. domestic production. There is no longer any waterborne import. This is from 2010, by the way. There's no longer any waterborne imports in the middle of the United States. If you're going to produce more oil, you're going to have to move it to the coastal refiners. That's just the fact of life. And if you don't move it efficiently, wellhead values will fall. People in Alaska, I'm sure, are well aware of this. If it costs a lot to get it to the market, your wellhead values fall, and they can fall below the cost of production. Here you can see the sort of major choke points. And there, and by the way, this, if you remember that first slide I showed you about the gas, this is really important, why forecasters should have humility. When DOE did their study of the Keystone Pipeline, they said, well, you know, okay, maybe it should be approved, maybe not. But it doesn't really matter. We have a lot of excess capacity through alternative pipelines and routes. Turns out they completely missed this surge in domestic production, which began to suck up all the excess capacity. We are now running unit trains, you know, 100-car trains, so-called unit trains from North Dakota to St. James, Louisiana. The only other place in the world where they do that kind of thing was in the old Soviet Union. It is a very high-cost fix. We should have an efficient pipeline system. And that leads me to another question I'll get to later about the way we permit and the way we regulate this enormous potential economic activity is going to be very critical. Now, anyone who doesn't think not having infrastructure, and boy, if you're from Alaska, you understand this, it doesn't affect your wellhead values, doesn't involve real economic penalty, need to just look at this chart. This shows you the value of essentially wellhead values in North Dakota. We call it a Clearbrook. Clearbrook is one of the main choke points. Because this production is surging so fast, and because they can't get it out, the prices are being depressed rather dramatically over their true value in the marketplace. We really have to fix this problem. This shows you the increase in North Dakota crude oil transport by rail over time. And you can see that the rail shipments continue to grow. So, you know, so what does this all mean? You know, how should we think about all of this? And I'll tell you, before I get to that, let me just leave you one thing. We have had growth, though, economic growth in the U.S. In the federal sector. And if you look at this, chart, one of the main areas of growth we've had in between March 10th and March 11th is in jobs at federal regulatory agencies. And that's why I think this story, you know, this story about this taking place on private land, I just want you to think about that. No NEPA. No oversight from the federal government. Yes, they can intervene in clean water and things like that, but most of the environmental issues get worked out locally. The local governments, the state governments, can act in their own interest. So what does this all mean? We're going to get major pipeline infrastructures to deliver sustained and large-scale benefits. We need to rehabilitate this infrastructure. Private capital is ready to be deployed to do that. The long-run price of oil is probably not as high as you think. I'll give you two statistics. One, if the long-run price of oil is $20 less than your forecast, let's say it's 100 instead of 120, or 80 instead of 100, present value savings to the national economy is $1 trillion. It's a very big deal. But that's not the whole story. There's another $1 trillion, and that's in all the value-added processing. But this is happening so fast and so quick that the way we traditionally regulate and permit new projects in the U.S. is not going to work. because we're going to push this crude back in the ground if we don't figure out how to process. By the way, you cannot export crude oil from the continental United States, except across pipeline in Canada and Mexico a bit. But you can't like export waterborne oil without a permit from the Commerce Department. You're very unlikely to get that permit. So we're going to have a big mismatch between light and heavy crude in the Gulf. We're going to have real problems in processing that crude if we don't get the permitting sorted out. So that's, in my view, is a sort of fundamental problem. If we're going to embrace this renaissance, and this renaissance is going to do lots of things. Within 10 to 15 years, with the Brazilian subsalt, there's going to be no imports into the Western Hemisphere from the Middle East. That's over. The U.S. is probably going to be a dominant provider of petroleum products for the Western Hemisphere, largely from the Gulf refiners. And more importantly, it's a kind of fundamental paradigm shift. It shifts the strategic outlook for the United States. It provides higher levels of economic growth. And so the real question for all of us is, okay, what do we have to do for, you know, what's the role of the government in embracing this or managing it in a way that we get these benefits? And these benefits also make the choice between these high-cost alternative fuels really a fundamental issue for the country. And I'll leave it there and open up for questions.
Mr. Pularisi, I want to just shift you away from the podium for just a second here. Want to remind the audience, as you ask your questions, please wait for the roving microphone to get to you before you ask the question. And Carrie back here has got the microphone, so wave your hand, be patient, she'll spot you and come to you. And then we want to also remind you about our next upcoming program on May 4th with Kathy Kelvin, who will be discussing Alaska and the United Nations. We're more connected than you know, so please make your RSVPs for that to happen. And, you know, as a financial planner, and all those mountain charts you were showing was just making my heart just go straight up. I mean, I was just really excited. So thank you for the perspective on the oil, gas business and the opportunities that are there. And, again, to reiterate what Joe has said, you know, we are a membership-supported organization. And if you're not a member of the Alaska World Affairs Council, the membership due that you would underwrite us for is to help bring these kinds of perspectives to the community. So please give some thought. At the back table, there's some membership cards, and Carrie's ready to go around and grab questions as they arise. So Lou, back to you.
Yeah, actually, before we get started, I did want to say one last thing. I mean, one sort of, what's the lesson for Alaska? I mean, it's kind of obvious. And for me, the lesson for Alaska is, particularly with these enormous and great reserves on the North Slope, is you need to find a way to deal with the uncertainty in the value of that crude oil. And that means you're going to have to align the interests of capital. Because, you know, capital's a coward. If it gets bad, it's going to leave, you know. So you're going to have to find a way to deal with this uncertainty and the price risk and align the interests of capital with the interests of the owners, which are the state of Alaska and ultimately the federal government if we ever open up ANWR. So I think that's a really kind of fundamental story from the outside for Alaska, if you're looking for one.
Yeah. Yes, it was an amazing speech, amazing for its omissions. You neglected to comment on the aspects of global warming and the environmentally destructive aspects of extracting oil and gas. You're probably a global warming denier because your wallet depends on that, but 99% of climate experts agree that man-made global warming is a problem. And all you have to look at is the melting Arctic ice, the acidification of the oceans, and the rising temperatures, to the point where the military has planned for this in their quadrennial report. Now, what I'd like to say is we need to act on global warming, and my name is the Lorax, and I speak for the trees. I speak for the bears. I speak for the bees. I speak for the fishes. I speak for the birds. I ask you all to hear my words. If we do not act and do not act fast, our chance to save the planet will have passed.
Okay, well, maybe I can talk about it. Thank you for your comments. And so, first, we're not experts on global warming, on climate, okay? Let me just say this. I think if climate's a problem, and actually, I'm agnostic, I don't know. By the way, the first thing I'd like to say is, issues of science should never be determined by majority rule. we should have a scientific method. If that were the case, Galileo would have been, you know, sort of an unfortunate circumstance. So science should be determined by the scientific method. So, but let's put that aside. If there is a serious environmental cost associated with oil and gas production, then we have to compare that penalty against its value and benefit. To have a strategy that says we just shouldn't do it is kind of crazy, because all that wealth that is available to us can lower unemployment rates. I mean, the public health effects of high employment are also quite high. So we have to make these trade-offs in a really fundamental and careful way. And you may be right, but even that would suggest that we should tax the combustion of the fuel, not its production. Its value is still there. It has more value in the marketplace than it costs to produce it. What you're arguing is that value is not worth it, that the cost, that the environmental cost of that value is too high, and I want to forego it. But that's the right debate we should have, not a debate about we should stop it because of global warming. Because the cost of transitioning to these alternative fuels may be very, very expensive, and there may be a lesser cost, a least costly way to do it. That's really all my point. Next question.
What is your assessment of the risk that energy markets are or will be manipulated by our political adversaries?
You know, I think there is a risk of that. We have a big debate in our own organization on whether, you know, speculative markets are represent the fundamentals or not. There is a piece we did in 2008, was published in the Oil and Gas Journal. I'm sure everyone read it, you know, and so, but it's on our website. And it examines our perspective, in which we believe that the run-up in oil prices in 2008 was driven by a lot of fundamentals, but it was fundamentals on the future. What buyers and sellers believe about the future. By the way, if you go to the futures market now, it's what we call highly backward dated. In other words, if you go out, and I'm not saying that the futures market is necessarily a good forecaster of what prices are going to be, but what do buyers and sellers believe now? They believe that the price of oil is going to be high for a while, and then it's going to come down. That's going to come down, you know, $80, $90 a barrel. So that's about all I can tell you on that. Next question.
Thank you for your very informative lecture and responses to questions. Here in Alaska, we're, as you may have heard since you got here, we're all roiled up on issues of gas pipelines. And I'm wondering what light you could throw on that in terms of the what you've discussed in terms of what's going on in the South 48. It is one of the prime prospects was that TransCanada was going to build a pipeline to the Midwest. There are good arguments for that in the sense that it, price-wise, it can beat imported gas from outside. But if the prices are all way down there, who's going to build any pipeline? Do you have any comment on that?
I think you've answered the question. Okay, you cannot, as far as I know, and we haven't done detailed work on that, but we believe that if you got the gas for free in the North Slope and you moved it all the way to the American Canadian-American border, you're probably talking $7, $8. It's going to be a long time before we see those prices in the U.S. It's a long road back to $5 gas. We'll get there, but it's a long road back.
Same is true for export, isn't it?
Export is interesting. We only have a lot of, we don't have a lot of data yet, but we do have one interesting project, the Cheniere project in Sabine Pass, right? The Koreans purchased, did a processing deal. It's a very interesting deal. They said, look, we will purchase Henry Hub at 115% of its value, whatever it is, and we will contract with Cheniere to process the gas for $3, to turn it from a gas to a liquid, and then we will send a tanker to the Sabine Pass to pick it up. So we do know that if, let's say Henry Hub is $4, and you can process it for $3, that gives you $7, and if you can get it to Korea for $1 to $3, it depends on your calculations for the Panama Canal and its expansion and what the tariff structure is going to be, you're into the Pacific Rim, $10, $11, I think in worst case scenario. And that's a very competitive place to be. So within the U.S. there's a big, a kind of a little war going on between the petrochemical guys and the power plants and the owners of the gas, because owners of the gas want to export it. But the power, you know, the utilities and the petrochemical guys are worried that that could drive the price up. So that's yet to be determined how we're going to work that out. But under U.S. law, if you have a free trade agreement with the United States, it's almost automatic approval. But I guess the bottom line is, no one's going to build a pipeline from Alaska to the lower 48, okay? I just think that's not going to happen.
Hi, happy Friday. I really enjoyed your speech. And something that I brought for anybody that's interested, I was wondering if it's been looked at by your group, is a report that was put out by the Offshore Validation Group in England just over a year ago about offshore wind and tidal energy, and they actually found that they'd be able to outproduce what's being produced right now on the North Slope. So I was just curious because in my experience in Pennsylvania, a lot of the horizontal fracking has already caused a lot of environmental damage. I know the Michelle Shell Research Center at Penn State has been looking into some of the environmental impacts, but also the economic impacts of that production there. I'm not sure how much research is going on in other states right now. But I was wondering, when you're looking at these forecasts, have you been doing more of a life cycle analysis approach to some of these economic models? Because I'm an economics student for environmental economics, and I feel like that's something that a lot of models are missing, because so many of the environmental costs are externalized so often, but that value is still very important to the overall look of reality. And I think if we reduce the factors that we put into these models too much, it's going to take it out of the context of reality. So I'm just curious, when you're looking at this, you're just looking at the costs of production, like the infrastructure that it takes to do it at the wellhead, and then the price of future values for maybe the next couple years, and then you're looking at what infrastructure will help to get oil and gas that we can't get to right now, or?
I don't disagree with you. Okay. If you could give us, I mean, we're not really experts on that, but we try to get it, we're really good at figuring out what things cost. That's how we spend our time. We don't have a lot of respect for a lot of the big Markel models. You know, you blow up New York and GNP goes down 0.1%. You know, they're kind of wacky. So we have a problem. So we do everything from the bottom up. What does it cost? And if someone tells me the compliance costs to meet the environmental standards under the EPA guidelines is X, we'll put it into our numbers. We don't have a problem with that. Now you're asking another question, which is, well, there's some other costs that are not being captured. And our view is, okay, then let's compare that cost to whatever the value is. But we're very open about that. And unlike EIA, we actually give you all our data. You know, we show you how we did it. And you'll never figure out what EIA did with their models, okay? You'll never figure it out. So, and the next point is, there's a lot of economic value to oil and gas production in Pennsylvania. There are parts of that state that were devastated that have really turned around. So you might argue, there's been a million frack jobs in the U.S., right? That the problems with fracking have nothing to do with the fracking, they have to do with cement casing. If you do your casing right, it doesn't matter whether it's a vertical well or a fracking well. People talk about water use. Water use in the production of biofuels is roughly 50 to 70 times higher than water use in the production of oil and gas. By the way, you talk about Macondo, the biggest threat to the Gulf of Mexico are the large-scale biofuel production, the nitrogen runoff into the Mississippi River, which has created a large dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So even the alternatives sometimes come with environmental consequences. You know, you've got the windmills and the birds and all that. By the way, I asked people, what's the cost of electricity in Alaska? When they gave me the number, it seems to me windmills make sense in Alaska. They don't make sense in Florida, where the price of electricity is like 8 cents a kilowatt hour. I mean, I don't know what's here. It's like 40, 50 cents, something like that. So what things cost, my only message to everyone is what things cost is really important. And we might have a vision of the future based on something we'd like it to be. But if we don't take the time to figure out the resources it takes to do that, we're kind of just have a religious model instead of a data-driven model. And we need a data-driven model, for us anyway, you know. Yep.
I don't need a microphone. Yeah. Oh, I do, okay. Hey, I was just curious about your models when you talked about how much, you know, the tremendous opportunities in the lower 48, talked about those huge quantities of oil. Is the total capital formation, jobs, positive benefits, and how about the railroad infrastructure for a lot of moving
it's
all
actually,
of those goods? Could you talk about those positive benefits?
I don't want to be too hard on the rail, by the way, because our chairman was the former president of Burlington Northern Railroad. But I don't want to get too far into it. From a point of view of options demand, the rails, you know, the Savage, there's huge, some of the rail infrastructure makes a lot of sense. Right now, for example, Bakken crude is moving to Pad 1. Does everyone know Pad 1? That's the East Coast. They move Bakken crude to Albany, New York by rail through the CMP and the CMP system, $18 to $20 a barrel. I mean, you know, if you've studied petroleum most of your life, that's kind of a colossal number, $18 to $20. I mean, you couldn't even, oil didn't even used to cost that much. And that's the thing I like to keep in mind. There's these big arbitrage opportunities out there. Does anyone understand what I'm talking about? I mean, the difference between what oil is worth in one place and what it's worth somewhere else. And that's true for gas. And as long as that arbitrage is out there, there's lots of people running around figuring out how to take it. And that's not going to go away. And that's why, you know, I have a good friend who dominates the consulting in the Pacific Rim, Faridun Feshiraki. I don't know if you know him, but Faridun's a really smart guy, and he keeps it low. The Pacific Rim natural gas price is always going to be what it is because they, you know, the buyers and sellers like it tied to oil. And I said, Faridun, there's too much money on the table. Someone's going to run after it, you know. And so that's the takeaway on that one. Yeah.
So in Alaska, much of our land is owned by the federal government, lots and lots.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. What can we do about that? Or how can we work around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, in my view, that we've not developed ANWR. I mean, there's so much wealth there that, I've always felt the federal government should just cede all its land to the states, let the states figure it out. But, you know, that's not going anywhere in Washington. I just think you have to work the system. You have to keep pinging on the government structure and educate people. I mean, I cannot tell you. I have been in, and there's a real disconnect. Let me tell you a little interesting environmental story. The 60 environmental groups wrote the President of the United States a year ago, and they signed a letter saying, you should put a ban on hydraulic fracturing for at least 1 year. Because of the environmental damage and everything. Some of the big guys, like Sierra Club, didn't sign it, but 60 people did. And a couple of the oil companies, which are, you know, they tend to be engineering-based guys and gals, you know, they sort of think that there must be a technical solution to this. Why don't you guys get together a group of engineers and environmental folks and see if we can work something out on this? And I said, you know, that sounds to me like a really bad idea. Because those people did not write the president. No one would write the president and tell him to ban hydraulic fracturing because they had a technical problem with the environment. Low natural gas is an existential threat to a large part of the environmental movement in this country. People liked high natural gas prices. They liked natural gas when it was relatively limited production and high cost. But when it's low, you can see it already. You can see the abandonment of subsidies and direct stuff for solar, for wind, and the renewable fuel program is under enormous pressure because the cost structures are out of line. That's the real issue. We have to get people to understand, okay, we have this lower cost alternative with all these economic benefits. So how do we capture those benefits and still get the environmental, you know, get the environmental values as well? And I think saying, well, we should just throw them away because the environmental values are priceless. It's just a kind of silly notion. You know, it's not an analytical approach. Any other questions?
Yeah, you said that the natural gas doesn't decline from source rock. I just wish you could clarify.
No, no. Here, let me be very clear. I said in the one field in Codell, right, which North Dakota Pipeline Authority has begun to do some research on, it showed the oil declining at a much more rapid rate than the natural gas. That is as far as I'm willing to take that statement. We need to expand that research and that effort to other hydraulic fractured fields. I agree.
But you weren't necessarily saying that the natural gas will renew itself or something.
No, no, no. I'm not an ambiotic. I mean, I'm not an ambiotic guy, okay? I mean, I'm just saying that the cost structure suggested that it was harder to keep the oil going than the gas. But really, it's such a small, it's a sample of one. We have to wait. We have to wait.
Not often I get a chance for a second question here.
Sure.
You refer to existential threats. Isn't what you're talking about an existential threat to coal mining too?
Absolutely. Of course, it depends. Coal can be quite competitive at certain, but I think under the existing environmental standards in the United States and the newly promulgated regulations and even if the air transport rule, which is under injunction now, that natural gas prices now are so low that they're not even good for the construction of new gas turbines. Because at $2 to $3 an MCF, people run them in the old turbines even though they're inefficient. So it's a problem for coal. I think it's going to be very tough to build another major coal plant in the United States. I don't think it's going to happen, but you know. That could be just a natural progression.
You read my mind.
Hey, I just wanted to take this chance to ask. So you said you guys do look at the EPA's like regulations and like the cost of regulations.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about looking at the cost for remediation of clean water, clean air, after these projects go in? Because I know right now, in some areas of Pennsylvania, people are having to get completely new water supplies because their wells have been poisoned. The same thing has happened in Colorado.
Here's what we know. First, let me talk to the specifics. There have been three cases in which EPA claimed that the wells had been contaminated, right? Every one of those cases, the Rageland case in Texas, the one in Pennsylvania, and maybe one in Utah, I don't remember, I can get you the data, EPA has withdrawn. And here's the problem. If you don't measure that well before and after drilling, I mean, I'll give you another story. When I was a kid, I was born in Carmel, California. I used to go down to Santa Barbara as a kid. There was no drilling. My mother used to chase after us to stay off the beach at certain times of the day because our feet came back filled with petroleum from natural seeps. So the American Indians often used natural gas. They used to light it. So we have huge natural seeps. By the way, in the Gulf of Mexico, if you go to the National Academy of Sciences study, what do you think the biggest source of oil into the Gulf of Mexico is? It's natural seeps. Followed by people who don't dispose of their oil change properly. That is the two major things. So any place there's oil and gas, there's going to be natural migration of methane. Some aquifers naturally have methane in them. So in order to do this experiment or to deal with this issue, you must have a good baseline. I think the companies are doing that. I'm not saying there hasn't been issues of contamination, but we have a huge set of data on fracking and drilling in this country, and we don't have a lot of data that shows that that's happened. So I think, you know, it's like when we sometimes we're on the dice with someone from NRDC and they show a bunch of pictures of this family that's had trouble with their gas in their wells and something. And I say, you know, that's not a scientific method. It might be true, but I mean, if you're going to promote that stuff, you'll at least take the time to do, you know, a scientific study. And that means you have to test it before and after, and that you have to do, you know, you have to set up a real experiment. Okay.
I think we're done.
Okay, great.
Well, Lou, again, on behalf of North Rim Bank and the Alaska World Affairs Council, thank you again for your great perspectives. And again, to all of you in the audience, thanks for joining us today. And please come to our next May 4th meeting. And again, go to the website on RSVP. See you again.